Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals are provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information. The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed in this podcast are solely of those of the hosts.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris the Chew Manchu, and I'm joined tonight by my co-host Sam and our producer Hartley. Hey guys.
Hello.
Hey.
Our guest tonight is Dr. Rebecca Vitale to discuss technology in diabetes care. But first, Sam, do you want to remind us about what the show is about?
I would love to. So we are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
We have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Vitale. Dr. Vitale is a MD, PhD, and Assistant Professor of Pediatrics and Medicine at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She is a dual-trained adult and pediatric endocrinologist and physician scientist who may or may not have spent a few too many years in training, her words. Inspired by her own experiences as a young adult with type 1 diabetes, her research focuses on supporting adolescents with diabetes who are transitioning from family support to self-management. And tonight, she teaches us about continuous glucose monitors and insulin pumps. Hey, Chris, do you know how CGMs are just like interns?
How?
They're actually less accurate on the first day and the last day.
That's good. And before we get into it, a quick disclaimer. Although we will talk about multiple brands during this episode, we tried to have a balanced and fair view at all of them. Hello, Dr. Vitale. Thank you for coming on the show.
Happy to be here.
First, because we're sort of an informal group, is it okay if we call you by your first name?
Yeah, please call me Becca.
Excellent. Now, Becca, since you're new to our show and our audience doesn't really know you, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and maybe something outside of medicine that you'd like to do?
Yeah. So I'm a med-peds endocrinologist and also a behavioral diabetes researcher. I've also had diabetes myself for 30 years, so I'm really steeped in diabetes land. Outside of work, I enjoy spending time outside, doing some distance running and hiking, baking with my six-year-old.
Amazing.
Baking. What do you like to bake with your six-year-old? What's a good baking recipe that can be done with a young child?
We make cookies pretty regularly. I feel like that's a classic for a reason. But recently, actually, my husband made cinnamon rolls with her, which were a big hit.
Ooh.
A little, he's the bread baker of the house, so a little beyond my expertise, but they came really good.
Nice.
That's ambitious.
Yeah, we tried with a two-year-old and not as successful. But I think I somewhere between two and six is when it hits, I imagine, right?
Yeah, around that age, we used to make granola. That was, you know, all you have to do is stir and dump, which that was
a right.
That age.
That's the skills. That's the skills. Stir and dump. I like that.
Yeah.
My current seven-year-old used to love watching cooking videos, but because we watched them on YouTube and watched cooking videos, he would watch with us. And we realized he was actually paying attention at one point when he had a bowl of Kix, and he was like two, but he had like a spoon and he was crushing the Kix and he was telling us it was peppercorns. I was like, peppercorn? Peppercorn?
Whoa.
I was like, oh, okay. So
he actually incredible.
Is, maybe we should watch. So the amount of screen time we're having with our two-year-old as we're just like holding him. So he's actually paying attention.
Yeah. Pros and cons.
Becca, I'm curious, we often ask this of our guests, but do you have a thought about what the best advice you've ever received in your career is?
Ooh, I think the biggest one for me, because I am a bit of a perfectionist, is the, like, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Like, sometimes at the end of the day, you just have to get your notes done, and they may not be perfect, but you just do your best, get it done, and get to where you need to be.
Hartley, that's probably pretty good for you right now.
As Hartley tries to do post-production on, 20 different episodes that she's already produced for us.
Yeah. No, but I just also remember as notes as a resident, too, that was like, the amount of time that I spent writing notes on four patients for my clinic is pretty exceptional.
Well, I think you learn so often along the way to be a perfectionist. Medical training teaches you that. And there comes a point where you just got to let it go.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. 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 Awesome. Well, we have so much to talk about. I'm going to skip my question. Haha. And take us to the case. Hartley, would you mind taking over?
Absolutely.
You know what nobody talks about in medicine? The mental load doesn't stop when you leave the hospital. After a full day of decisions, dinner is still waiting, and figuring it out can feel harder than it has any right to be. That's decision fatigue in its purest form, and honestly, that's why I love HelloFresh. HelloFresh doesn't try to turn you into a celebrity chef. It just removes the hardest part of weeknight dinner, which is figuring it out. They send you pre-portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipe cards, so instead of staring into the fridge after a long day of medicine, you're actually cooking something good in about 30 minutes. They've got over 100 recipes every week, including tons of high-protein options, Mediterranean meals, and stuff that actually keeps you full. The portions are generous, the ingredients are legit, and even the steak and seafood options don't cost extra. It's the kind of meal that makes you feel like you made a good life choice, even if everything else that day was chaos. I use HelloFresh because it really gives me my time back and my brain space back. You sit down, you eat, you're not stressed snacking at the counter while Googling, quote, easy dinner ideas. So, Cribsiders listeners, go to HelloFresh.com/Cribsiders10FM to get 10 free meals plus a free Zwilling knife, a $144.99 value on your third box. That's HelloFresh.com/Cribsiders10FM. Offer valid while supplies last. Free meals applied as discount on the first box. New subscribers only and varies by plan. HelloFresh, fewer decisions, better nights.
So our case today is a case from Cashlack Children's. Today we have Dex, who is an 8-year-old, otherwise healthy child who presented to her primary care doctor last week with fatigue, weight loss, polyuria. She was found to have a fingerstick blood glucose over 500. So she was admitted to the hospital and she's diagnosed with new onset type 1 diabetes. No one else in her family has diabetes. And while she was in the hospital, she was started on fingersticks to monitor her blood sugar with a basal bolus insulin regimen. And that has been going smoothly. So today she's here for her first outpatient follow-up visit with you, her endocrinologist. And her mom asks you about an insulin pump. So for today's episode, we're going to assume that our audience is generally familiar with the basics of type 1 diabetes diagnosis and management. And if they're not, we have an episode for that, episode 7 on type 1 diabetes. Everyone should listen to it. But today we're going to focus more on the diabetes technology, specifically continuous glucose monitors and insulin pumps. So let's start with continuous glucose monitors. Can you tell us how they actually work?
Yeah, absolutely. So a CGM, a continuous glucose monitor, you'll hear them called CGM, it's not actually measuring blood glucose. So I think that's the first part to be aware of is the sensor actually goes into the subcutaneous fat and you're just measuring the glucose in the interstitial fluid. I think the thing to be aware of with this is that glucose equilibrates in the blood much faster than it equilibrates in the sub-Q fat and in the interstitial fluid. So CGMs are going to just naturally give you a little bit of delay in where the blood sugar is. So the blood sugar will be about 15 minutes further down the road than you're actually measuring with the CGM. So you have this sensor, which is just a little wire that goes under the skin, and then it connects to a transmitter. And the transmitter is what actually sends the Bluetooth signal to someone's phone or insulin pump or a separate receiver to display the blood sugar. And so basically that whatever the signal is that's picked up by the sensor goes through like a mathematical transformation to then be calibrated with the blood, the actual blood glucose. And then there's also this 15-minute delay. So, they're never going to be exactly the same as a fingerstick blood glucose would be, but they give you a pretty good estimate.
And are endocrinologists feeling as this technology advances, even, you know, when this episode comes out, there might even be something new. Like how comfortable are you guys now as endocrinologists with those numbers? You know, when we talk about accuracy, talk about that type of thing, are you like, hey, I trust this all the way, or I'm always thinking back up? How are you feeling about those numbers?
I mean, they've been CGM data has been approved to dose insulin since, I think, early 2016. And so really, we have almost a decade where we've been using these devices, in the readings from these devices in place of a blood sugar. I think that there's a lot of sometimes there's a lot of concern from families about the accuracy. I think the thing to keep in mind is that glucose meters are also not perfectly accurate when you compare them to, you know, an actual lab glucose. And the FDA has certain, you know, parameters that they look at of, you know, what percentage of the time are you within 10% of the true value? And they have these, you know, guidelines that they use when they're approving these different devices. And the accuracy of CGMs has actually gotten to be fairly similar to the accuracy of many glucose meters. So I'll be honest, when I'm prescribing a glucose meter, unless somebody has a very specific set of circumstances, I'm prescribing whichever one their insurance is going to cover. So I'm not looking back to the data to see, oh, you know, what's the accuracy of this meter versus a different meter. But some of those accuracies can vary significantly. So there was a study back in, I think, in 2017 that showed that these commercially available glucose meters, that these sort of inaccuracy can range from 5.6% to 20.8%, depending on the meter. And the CGM systems are all in sort of the 8 to 10%, 8 to 11% range right now. So actually, they have similar accuracy to some of the glucose meters. So for most people, we say, you know, trust the sensor. But I will say, the rule of thumb is, if you feel different than what the sensor is telling you, also trust your body. And you know, that's why everyone goes home with a glucose meter and, you know, has a glucose meter to be able to confirm. Because even if they may be of similar accuracy, two readings gives you a little bit more information than one.
Does the accuracy differ across the spectrum of blood glucoses? I feel like I've heard people say they always check lows. Or is it just that lows are more clinically significant?
So lows, all of the CGMs, and actually most of the glucose meters as well, are less accurate at low blood sugars. But the other piece to keep in mind is that the sort of like standards of accuracy are percentages. So they're also less accurate at high blood sugars because, you know, if you're okay with a 10% difference, you know, that's 300 versus 330 as opposed to 100 versus 110. And so those changes can be more, those acceptable differences can be greater at higher blood sugars. And then also you have the issue that they just all are less accurate when low, and particularly the CGMs are less accurate when they're low.
And we've been sort of talking about CGMs in sort of a general sense. I think now I'd like to ask you a little bit more about like the different types of brands, because I know that there each company is a little different, and we're going to try to cast a broad net and talk about most of the major brands so that we have a balanced discussion about them. But I do know that, you know, I've used one brand, and I know that that's replaced every 14 days, and the sensor is replaced every 14 days. And I do another one, I was like, oh no, that's every 10 days. And then there's other ones that now they're extending to 15 days. Could you can you discuss a little bit about the major differences between each brand and why one would choose one versus another? I know outside of insurance issues.
Yeah. So, you know, there are four major brands of CGM available and approved in the U.S. right now. So the one that's most popular, that has the biggest market share, particularly in type 1 diabetes, is Dexcom. And their most recent version is the Dexcom G7. And this is the one that you replace every 10 days, but actually just got approved for adults to extend to 14 days. But in kids, it's still going to be 10. So no changes in the pediatric setting for that. So the Dexcoms are approved for 10 days. The other, I would say, the sort of second most popular one is the Freestyle Libre. And the most recent version of that is the Freestyle Libre 3 Plus. And that one has a 14-day wear. So that one, you get a little bit longer wear with it. I think these two devices, actually, the way that we measure CGM accuracy, which I referenced earlier, is something called the MARD, which is the mean absolute relative difference, which is a terrible name, but it's basically the average difference between the CGM reading and a reference lab glucose. And actually, the FreeStyle Libre 3 and the Dexcom G7 have exactly the same MARD. So at least per the studies, they are similarly accurate. The reason a lot of kids with type 1 end up using Dexcoms is that Dexcom got a bigger market share of integration with the automated insulin delivery pumps, which we'll talk about a little later, I'm sure. And so it's only recently that some of these pumps are compatible with the FreeStyle Libre. So we may see that Libre will end up getting, you know, a larger market share over time as they become compatible with more of these integrated systems. The other two brands, so Medtronic was primarily an insulin pump maker initially in diabetes world. And then they expanded to CGMs as well. And so their CGM is called, most recent is called the Guardian 4. Its accuracy is a little bit less in the studies. So its MARD is around 10 point in the tens, and the MARD of the other two is in the eights. So not terribly different from another, still well within the range of what we see from the finger stick glucose monitors, but slightly less accurate. And up until the last version, so the Guardian 3 still required regular calibration, which means doing a finger stick and entering that into the system. Whereas the Dexcom and the Libre, their most recent versions, don't require calibration and haven't for a little bit of time here. And so, you know, when it's finger sticks or no finger sticks, it's a hard sell to say, oh, I'd rather do the finger sticks. So I think that's part of why, you know, Medtronic lost favor maybe a little bit. And then the last one that's out there is called the Eversense. This one is probably the one that's used the least because it's an implantable sensor. So it goes in a lot like a Nexplanon. And so it just goes into the subcutaneous tissue, and then you place the transmitter on top of it, and then you change the external transmitter once a day. So there's still an external part of it, and then it, you know, goes out to the receiver. The Eversense, I think right now, is not integrated with any of the closed loop pumps. I think they're working on it with one of them, and I honestly can't remember which, but I think that's another reason that it hasn't gained as much sort of momentum in the type 1 diabetes world, is because people are looking for something that's compatible with those pumps.
Now, you said something, so you talked a little bit about how the different receivers may have sensors and how often they're replaced as sort of like the consumable, but you just talked about a receiver. Now, not all these different types have receivers necessarily that are separate, and some people actually just have a phone app. Can you describe which ones have which options?
Yeah. So Dexcom and Libre will both read out to a phone app. And so some people, particularly for younger kids who the parents may not want to invest in a smartphone for their four-year-old, they may just use the receiver. The benefit of the phone app is that if the sensor is reading to a device that's connected to the internet, you can then have a share app where the parent far away can see what the child's blood sugars are. So if somebody has a receiver, an independent receiver, which, you know, you get through the pharmacy, it's a device specifically just to read the blood sugars. If that's the device you're using to read it, the parent can't see what the blood sugars are from afar. So I think a lot of times it is a priority for parents. They feel safer being able to see those blood sugars. So Dexcom and Libre both have that capability. I honestly do not have enough patients that use Medtronic and Eversense to know off the top of my head whether they do have that capability. I think Medtronic likely does. I would guess that they both likely do, but I just don't have as much personal experience with it.
So we're going to end up talking a little bit more about how these things integrate in prescribing and things like that in a second, but I think we should complete our conversation by talking about the insulin pumps first, and then we can really talk about everything before we move on to the nitty gritty. Although the one comment I do want to say is I love that the actual glucometers are not perfect either. And so the idea that all of a sudden you're saying, oh, this is so much better. You know, we should really do finger stick. That doesn't mean anything. The finger stick machine also has a 10% MARD, if I'm using the word correctly, you know, versus versus short versus a venous glucose sample, which obviously you're only getting in the hospital. So I think that actually like makes me feel a whole lot better about like, oh yeah, we got to check. The hospital tells me we need to check with a finger stick meter. It's like, what? That meter is just as bad as the other thing.
And I will say the hospital ones are better than the home ones. So the hospital ones do have a little bit better accuracy, but it's still not as good as a venous sample, and they're still not perfect.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So I'll let my hospital off the hook a little bit is what you're saying, but that's it. All right. So the insulin pumps, kind of the same concept here. How do the insulin pumps work? What's actually going on with this quote pump?
So an insulin pump, just in its basic sense, is just a reservoir of insulin and a piston that gives it at very precise amounts. And so, you know, when the pumps were first invented, the story I've been told is that the idea actually came from the like backpack chemo pumps that kids were starting to have, that for these like long infusions, that there was an option to carry it around. And, you know, somebody sort of put the idea together, well, why couldn't we do that with insulin? And so it's just a different, the sort of old school manual mode pumps, which we'll talk about the difference in a moment, really it's just a different way of delivering insulin. The biggest difference is that, you know, when we think about insulin, we think about somebody's background need, the amount your body needs at all times to stay safe and healthy and out of diabetic ketoacidosis. So that amount is called the basal. That's the background insulin that somebody needs to get through their day. And then anytime you're taking in carbohydrates, you need to give what we call bolus insulin to cover the carbohydrates you're eating. With an insulin pump, you know, when somebody's doing injections and, you know, in the case where they talked about, you know, the basal bolus insulin regimen. So that's somebody who's on an injection of a long-acting insulin that lasts for 24 hours a day, and then separate injections of rapid-acting insulin when you eat. In an insulin pump, you're only using one kind of insulin. You're only using the rapid-acting insulin. You're just delivering it at very short intervals, every sort of 1 to 5 minutes over the course of the day to cover that person's basal background need. And then you can, with the push of a button, you can give the insulin that you need to cover a meal. Another sort of like nice feature is that they all have an integrated calculator in them, because when we're dosing insulin, we're usually doing it based on a carbohydrate ratio. So you're giving a certain amount of insulin for the amount of food that somebody's eating, and then also additional insulin to cover any hyperglycemia, any high blood sugars that they're having. And it's math, and it's not always math that's easy to do in your head. We all have calculators on our phone now, but you know, when I was a kid, it's a lot of math to try to do in your head to figure out how much insulin your child needs. And so these, just from an error correction perspective, having those integrated calculators in the pump where you can program in the carbohydrate ratio and the correction factors at different times of day, enter in the blood sugar, enter in the carbohydrates someone's eating, and then just tells you how much to give. It just takes one variable out of the equation. And so the newer insulin pumps that are available, and these have been around for probably 8 or 9 years now, are these automated insulin delivery pumps. And so the way that these work is they are automatically adjusting insulin delivery, either by changing the background basal rate or by giving automated boluses, based on an algorithm which predicts what the blood sugar is going to be in 30 to 60 minutes based on what the blood sugar has been doing before. So you need a continuous glucose monitor for this, because it needs to be able to see the trend of the glucose. And it predicts where you're going to be in 30 to 60 minutes based on how much insulin is still active in the body and what the glucose trend has been. And then it can give extra insulin or withhold insulin to try to prevent high and low blood sugars.
Very sophisticated.
Yeah, it's been a big change. And I think I think for people who have been taking care of kids with diabetes for a long time, but may not be endocrinologists, you know, there's a big change in what's happened to pumps. And just by looking at a pump, you can't always tell how it's working. And so I think there is a little bit more confusion and uncertainty about the pumps than maybe there was 5 or 10 years ago.
I actually wanted to ask a question about that, because commonly the patients get admitted to the hospital and you have to, like, they have an insulin pump, and you're like, you got to put in the orders for the insulin pump, which fundamentally seems like doesn't make sense because they're actually using their own insulin pump. But having said that, I was just using that concept to try to understand what actually is going on in the insulin pump and like what you write as a prescription. Now, has that changed itself with these new pumps? Or if it's not, could you give us an example of like the average order I would put in for a quote insulin pump?
So are you talking about in the hospital, how would you put in an order for the pump?
Exactly. Because then that makes me understand what the insulin pumps are. Like, okay, it's really like we're trying to give 0.1 units every 5 minutes for a basal. Yeah. And then I'm trying to, you know, do a correction factor of something. Just like an example of what we're putting in an order for an insulin pump so I can kind of understand what it's actually doing. And then therefore, if the patient gets admitted to me and they don't get put in an endocrinology service, then they're like, please order the insulin pump. I'll say, I got this. I'm going back to this episode and I'm going to figure it out.
Yeah, so the settings that you enter in the pump actually vary quite a bit from system to system. And I will also say that the rules at different hospital systems vary quite a bit as well as to whether, and you know, I've been at the hospital where I am for the last 2 years. The hospital I was at before that had different rules. So I think this is changing, and depending on when you listen to this in time, it may have changed by then. But in this moment in time, some hospitals will allow automated insulin delivery pumps. The challenge with an AID, automated insulin delivery, AID, the challenge with an AID pump in the hospital setting is you don't actually know what it's going to do. It may not be until later on that you can even tell how much insulin was given by the pump. And I think from a, like, you enter the orders, the medication is given as written perspective, that's a really challenging thing to figure out how to order. In the hospital systems I've worked in, what they ask for is what are the settings that are entered into the pump. And so the settings that can be entered into the pump are the basal rates, so the amount of insulin that's given in the background throughout the day, the carbohydrate ratios, so how much you're giving for carbohydrates that are eaten. And again, those can vary and be different throughout the day. The correction factor, which is how much one unit of insulin is expected to lower the blood sugar, and that can vary throughout the day. And then the target, so what are you aiming for when you're calculating how much correction to give, and that can vary throughout the day. So typically what they'll want is those four things with timed settings of what of when everything is given. But when we go in and talk about all the different systems that are available out there right now, what you will see is many of them do not have adjustable settings for some of those things because it relies on the algorithm to do its work. And, you know, there's one of them that to start the pump, literally all you put in is a target and the patient's weight. And so, and it actually can be really difficult in the system, even like in logging into the cloud, and it can be difficult to figure out how much insulin is being given. And so I think just from a hospital systems standpoint, this is really challenging. And, you know, when I'm writing an insulin prescription in the outpatient world, I can just write, you know, use up to 50 units a day per insulin pump as per MD instructions. And that's how much insulin, you know, that's how much insulin they use. And most insurance companies and pharmacies are okay with it because they don't want me putting in all those settings into the prescription box. And they also change regularly. So it's not something that's realistic to be changing every time we make a change to the pump settings. But it's harder in the inpatient setting. So every hospital is going to have a different procedure for this. So I would say, you know, get to know your friendly local endocrinologist and just learn what your hospital's policies are, because, you know, as of a couple years ago, some hospitals were not allowing people to stay in the automated mode in the inpatient setting. And there may be hospitals out there that still are not allowing that.
That's really cool to hear. I mean, I went to medical school where Becca is a doctor. And when I was a medical student, we were taught the first thing you do is put it in manual mode. And so it's really cool to see that even in the past 2 or 3 years, those policies have evolved.
So, Cribsiders listeners, let's talk about something that actually changed my day-to-day life as a hospitalist. Figs. I can't walk into a clinic or hospital without seeing people in fig scrubs. And I get it. I wear them too. So, new year, new you, or at least new uniform. If you're in healthcare, it's the perfect time to upgrade your scrubs to Figs. They're lightweight, durable, super functional, and ridiculously soft. These scrubs get it. That's what drew me in and keeps me coming back. And because we work with kids, and kids come with messes, I love that Figs are antimicrobial, can withstand wash after wash, and come out wrinkle-free. I've washed mine over 50 times, and they still look brand new. So, with new limited edition colors and styles, Figs is putting the fresh in uniform refresh. Scrubs, outerwear, footwear, accessories, and more, you'll be looking sharp, feeling good, and ready to take on anything. 2026 is here, so let's do this. And Cribsiders listeners, you can take 15% off your first order at wearfigs.com with the code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX.
I think it would be helpful now to maybe talk through some of the major systems for insulin pumps. And then we can sort of talk more about the CGM insulin integrated system. So let's talk through brands.
Yeah. So there are five brands that are approved in the US right now. And one of them still is on limited release and just started shipping pumps, I think, in early July. So one of them you likely haven't heard of yet, but is coming soon. So the sort of oldest system that's out there, the system that's been around for the longest that's currently operating, is the Medtronic system. And they were actually the first ones to have the hybrid closed loop system. And so this is a tubed pump. So it's a separate pump. It's a little, you know, device about the size of a pager that connects to a tube that connects to an infusion set, which is the cannula that enters the patient's body. Because this was the first one approved, they were really conservative in their algorithm. So the first pump that they had available with the AID system required a lot of calibrations, frequently would kick you out of the automated mode into manual mode if there was any possibility that the blood sugars were inaccurate. And people got really frustrated with that system. Many people did. So this used to be the leader in insulin pumps. Medtronic was the system that the majority of people used. And I think it does have a lower market share now, I think a little bit because that first system was so conservative. I think because they were probably trying to make sure it would be approved by the FDA because, you know, they had never approved an automated delivery system before. Insulin, that's a high risk medication. You can understand why people are anxious about this. But I would say the two pumps that sort of then came in to take over a bigger market share would be the tandem pumps. So there are two different versions of this. One is called the T-Slim X2, which is similarly like a little pager-sized device, has a touch screen, full color screen, which, you know, back in the day was a big deal. And they also have a newer version called the Mobi, which runs the same algorithm. So the background operating algorithm is the same, but it's much smaller and it doesn't have a screen. So the entirety of the pump runs from someone's phone. And so it's a phone app and the pump is very small, doesn't have a screen, and because it doesn't have a screen, they can make it small, right? And so it's just basically it's about half the size of the other sort of tubed pumps, but it's still a tubed pump that has an external tubing that connects to the body. So the Medtronic and Tandem systems, both you can adjust similar things. You can basically make adjustments to almost anything in the any of those settings that I discussed that you would enter, and this will impact the insulin delivery. Probably the most popular pump on the market right now is the Omnipod 5. This is the one that doesn't have any tubing. So it's a patch pump that sits directly on the skin. And basically what's sitting on the skin is a reservoir and a motor. And so in that ways, it's kind of similar to the Mobi pump because the pump itself doesn't have a screen and it's entirely controlled by a separate device. So until very recently, this was a phone-like device called a PDM or a personal diabetes manager, I think. But recently they now have integrated with both iPhones and Androids to have a phone app that you can control the pump through. And actually the tandem pump, both of those pumps can be controlled through a phone app as well. So it does make it just a lot easier to be able to do it through the phone. And, you know, young people love this because it doesn't have any tubing. It's not going to catch on a door handle, which is a very frustrating experience. And, you know, for people who are playing a lot of sports, who, you know, don't want to have to deal with finding a place to, you know, put the device on their body, you know, I think it's really popular because of that. With the Omnipod, adjusting the basal rates doesn't do anything because it has this like machine learning algorithm where with every pod, it learns what your insulin needs are. So someone's programmed basal rate actually might be quite different from the insulin that they're getting. And so that is something that you can log into the cloud and see how much somebody's getting, but it's not, you know, not all of the settings are adjustable in the same way as with Medtronic and Tandem.
I was just going to ask, you know, we've brought up phone apps a lot now, and knowing many adolescents and teenagers and the popularity of buying external batteries for the phones, like what if the phone dies or they chucked it off a building or something like that? Like what do they do? Is there some sort of backup?
Yeah. So they will all default to their programmed settings if they are, you know, sort of removed from the algorithm. And actually the Mobi, the Tandem pump, continues, like it will, the algorithm will continue running. You just can't see what's happening. And so the Mobi does have a physical button that you can push to give, there's like a sort of setting where you can push it. If you push it a certain number of times, you give that certain number of units. There's like a rhythm of button pushes that you have to do to activate that. But there is a way to do it. Typically, that's something I talk about with patients when they are wanting to use one of these. I'm like, what's your phone situation like? Like, are you someone who's always running on 1%? We need to come up with a plan for this if this is the pump you really want. And I think, you know, the Omnipod, at the very least, does have, you know, if somebody finds their phone is always dying, they can go back to using the PDM, which doesn't die. You don't have to charge it nearly as often as you have to charge a phone. But with both the devices themselves and with the phones that control them, keeping things charged is a huge issue in diabetes care, which is obviously very different than it used to be. So there are two other systems that I'll just touch on briefly. One is called the Beta Bionics iLet. This is the one that is the most hands-off of any insulin pump system out there. This is the one that you only enter the patient's weight and the target, either 110, 120, or 130. And those are the only settings you put in. It uses the first 3 days, so you instruct the patient to sort of eat very typical meals for themselves over those first couple learning days, and it learns the patient's habits. And so it comes up with a typical breakfast bolus, a typical lunch bolus, and a typical dinner bolus. And then within that, when people are giving insulin, they can say if they're eating less, as in 50% less, more, as in the usual amount, usual, as in the usual amount, and then more, which is 50% more than they're usually eating. And then, you know, you just give the bolus. You don't have to count carbohydrates. You give the bolus based on how much, you know, just in general, how much you're eating. So I think a lot of endocrinologists are having to adjust to that because that's a really different, there's nothing I can adjust on it. So it's difficult for me when I have a patient who's using it to I have to think very differently than I think with the other pumps. And I think that has been one challenge with all these systems is that it changes. You have to think about which device they're on, what settings are adjustable, and also how the pump, you know, each of them uses the program settings a little bit differently within that algorithm. And so, you know, in the Omnipod and the Tandem pumps, for example, it's really important to keep somebody's, if there are significant changes in the weight, keep those changes updated because insulin is weight-based. And for some of those auto corrections, they're calculating that from the person's weight and what they would expect a correction dose to need to be rather than the programmed setting. And so it has gotten more complicated.
Now, I can see that being frustrating as a physician or endocrinologist, but at the same time, it seems like on the opposite side, as the end user, it has some more customer-friendly portions, which I feel like traditionally things like insulin pumps were sort of were almost kept away from some of our patients who had more medical literacy issues or other problems that maybe the lack of needing to do so many more manual things makes it actually more accessible to some of our patients.
So I think that's a huge and really important point, and a point that's near to my heart. Actually, my research focuses on people who have executive function challenges like ADHD, autism spectrum difficulties, who also have type 1 diabetes, and how can we best support them in managing their diabetes. And so I think historically there was this idea within endocrinology that, you know, there are some people who are more and less appropriate for a pump, that there are some people that the risk is too high. And, you know, that risk is the risk of diabetic ketoacidosis. When you only have short-acting insulin going into the body, the amount of time that it takes to develop DKA is much shorter. And when you have a plastic tube underneath the skin that is what's delivering that insulin, if that gets kinked, if somebody, you know, is a fast healer and that site is getting clogged or clotted off, then you can actually pretty quickly go into DKA, sometimes without people realizing it. I think with CGMs now, people are seeing those unexpected higher blood sugars, and sometimes that can help mitigate their risk, but that's sort of the historical concern. There's a lot of data coming out now that maybe that risk isn't quite as high as we once thought it was, as we've educated people better about safety issues around the pumps. And now, you know, the American Diabetes Association in the American Diabetes Association Standards of Care, which they put out annually, the recommendation is that all people with type 1 diabetes be offered the opportunity to use an insulin pump. So I do think that we're starting to see a shift in who's being offered pumps. And I think there are lots of people, particularly people who are newly diagnosed, who are excited about the idea of not having to really like focus in on carb counting and be able to have a more hands-off pump. So I think there really are two camps. There is the very hands-on camp who like want to enter more data, really micromanage their diabetes, and there are people who want to be more hands-off. And I think, you know, as a med peds person, I see lots of adolescents and young adults who may fall more in the hands-off crew. But I think the last pump system that was just recently approved is called the Twist, with two I's, T-W-I-I-S-T. And this pump actually came out of the DIY diabetes community. And so this is an algorithm that was developed by people with diabetes, and people would purchase an Apple developer license and build an app for themselves on their phone to control older Medtronic pumps and then eventually Omnipod pumps with an algorithm. This was back in the time when the Medtronic 670G, that first automated insulin delivery pump, was the first one on the market. And people were really frustrated because they felt like the approval for the Tandem and Omnipod pumps in particular, which we knew were out in front of the FDA, they felt like those approvals were taking too long. And so there's like this online community, their sort of like mantra was, we are not waiting. And so people would build their own apps, and people with diabetes were the ones who built this algorithm. It's the most customizable algorithm. So the way this got to FDA approval is that that a company called Tidepool decided to sponsor a study just of the people already using the system. So it wasn't a randomized trial, but it was to show safety that of these people already using the system, we have all this data. And so they collected that data, and it was enough for an FDA approval. And so it took some time to find the right physical pump partner. And so this, like I said, this is one that has just started shipping this month, to in a limited release. So this is the most customizable system. The other systems, the lowest target you can set is 110. In the Twist, you can set a target as low as 87. And so for people who are really hands-on with their diabetes, who really want to be sort of like the most on top of it, who want to control all the pieces, enter all the data, these are the people who are going to be really excited about the twist. So I think I'm excited now that we have so many options out there, and there is the sort of like very high intensity, enter all the data pump. You can have a separate profile when you're on your period, that kind of thing. And there is the, all I have to do is announce when I'm eating and whether it's usual amount or more or less. And you know, it takes all kinds. And so I think it's great that we're finally getting to a point where there's a little bit more customization and fitting like the right device for the right person.
And so actually that's fantastic, because I actually wanted to ask you a little bit about the endocrinology side. You know, you were commenting that, hey, you know, when you just put in the weight and target level, you know, I don't get to touch anything, that perspective. When you have your clinic appointments and when you are adjusting, I assume these phone apps say, hey, you know, this is my carb correction. This is what my goal, my target goal is. This is my correction factor. This is what I'm about to eat. And you have to plug in the carbs and then it does it. So you're telling it that, hey, you're about to eat at that moment. When you're changing those carb corrections or other things like that, are you doing it physically online? Like, are you going up to the cloud as a admin person, as their endocrinologist? Or are you, like, when they come to clinic, you guys are like adjusting their settings and saying, hey, you know, change your correction factor to this, this, and this?
Great question. So you cannot push changes to the settings through the cloud. So that we can see, for most of these systems, we can see data from afar. And so we are able to see what some, so sometimes patients will message me between visits and say, hey, you know, I've been running really high. Maybe it's, you know, a pubertal teen who's got increased insulin resistance. I've been running really high, and I can tell them recommendations of how I would change their settings, and they are physically doing that on the pump. But you do have to physically make those changes on the pump. You can't like push it through the system. But I will say, I don't want to like speak ill of the Beta Bionics iLet, because I have patients who use it who have incredible control on it. I think in the times when it's not working well, I sometimes struggle to find, and they have guidelines for how to do this, but you know, this is one of the newer systems, and I think a lot of us are still learning the best ways to adjust it.
That's helpful. I'm curious, just to briefly go through it, I think I understand why these systems are helpful, right? It sounds like they would lead to tighter glucose control. You can see the data. All of that is good. It's easier for patients. Nobody has to get poked with needles as often. Are there other advantages to closed loop systems that we wouldn't necessarily think of right off the bat?
I think the biggest thing for me is they allow for some imprecision. Managing type 1 diabetes requires so much precision. And, you know, there's this sort of popular graphic showing the like 47 things that can impact glucose in a day. And, you know, there's the running joke that, you know, you can, if you try the same thing again and again, and you know, you should expect the same thing to happen, but that's not true in diabetes. I mean, I eat the exact same thing for breakfast every morning, and I have a really pretty set exercise schedule and other things, and I can never tell you when I'm going to go high or low after breakfast. It is, it's impossible to predict. And, you know, I say that as an endocrinologist who is aware of all these different factors that could be impacting it, but there are so many different things that impact your blood sugar. In some of the early studies of these AID systems, they tried to like sort of test the system by bringing kids, they took a bunch of kids skiing. So they're out there doing this like high intensity physical activity. And then they were comparing their different insulin needs. And so, you know, there's an example of these two nights where somebody had, you know, on the system had excellent, you know, or had in-range glucose control on both of those nights. And the total insulin delivered on one night was 50% of the total insulin delivered on the other night. So people's insulin needs vary dramatically based on other aspects. And so we do our best with carbohydrate ratios and correction factors. We try to, you know, we try to scientify it and make it something that is predictable, but it's not always predictable. And so to have a system that in the background has your back, that's adjusting so that, you know, if you ate out for dinner and you didn't know what the carb count was and you guessed too high, it will pull back on your insulin. It may not completely prevent the low, but it's not going to be as, it's unlikely to be as severe. or, you know, if today is, if you, you know, there's just a lot of different things that can impact the blood sugar. And so I think that not needing to have quite as much precision in dosing insulin is a the real benefit. And I do think, you know, a lot of people, a lot of studies show the mental load of diabetes decreases when you use these systems. So you're not having to think about diabetes quite as often with automated insulin delivery.
That makes a lot of sense.
You know what really eats up time when you're running a small business or side project? Payroll and HR. I've had days where a quick admin task turns into hours of forms, logins, and double-checking tax stuff, and I remember thinking, there has got to be a better way to do this. That's why I'm a big fan of Gusto. Gusto is online payroll and benefits software built for small businesses. It's all-in-one, remote-friendly, and incredibly easy to use, so you can pay, hire, onboard, and support your team from anywhere. What I love is how much it automates. Payroll tax filing just happens. Direct deposits are simple. And all the onboarding paperwork, offer letters, forms, everything gets handled in one place instead of scattered across my inbox. Plus, you get unlimited payroll runs for one monthly price, which means no surprises when things get busy. And if you ever have a tricky HR situation, Gusto gives you direct access to certified HR experts, which is honestly huge peace of mind. And so, if you're ready to save time and skip the admin headaches, try Gusto today at gusto.com/cribsiders and get 3 months free when you run your first payroll. That's 3 free months of payroll at gusto.com/cribsiders. One more time, gusto.com/cribsiders.
When you're talking to parents about continuous glucose monitors or insulin pumps, are there common misconceptions or myths or things that questions that you get as an endocrinologist?
One of the biggest misconceptions for people who might have done a lot of Googling is they don't understand that you still need to announce meals. You still need to, you know, input information. And honestly, some providers don't understand this as well. They hear about this closed loop and they're like, oh, so you put the pump on and then, you know, why is this person's A1C still high? They have the pump. It still takes work. It still takes a lot of work to manage these systems. And, you know, we haven't even gotten into the side of like supply acquisition and making sure the orders are in on time so you have everything you need to change a pump site if there's a pump failure in the middle of the school day, like all of these various issues. Like, there's still a lot of work that goes into these systems. So I do think they make life easier, but I think it's not perfect.
So let's kind of move on to the next piece. We'll take our patient Dex here. We decided that we're going to our first endocrinology outpatient appointment. We're going to talk about some of these devices. So for your end, you know, we talked about what different approvals you can have over time and things like that. But let's just say in an ideal world, how soon after diagnosis do you start kids on these, on a CGM versus an insulin pump, and when does it vary?
I would say there's a lot of discussion about this within the diabetes community right now, because everybody does need to learn fingerstick glucose and injections, because technology fails and that's your backup. So people do need to be comfortable with how to do these things. And so I think, you know, there are some places where, you know, they don't prescribe anything from the hospital. You wait until your first follow-up appointment. So you're at least having a couple days at home where you're doing the finger sticks, you're getting that experience with it. I would say in general, often the CGMs are prescribed within a week. Many places prescribe them straight from the hospital. We'll put a sample device on the patient in the hospital. Different places will do it different ways. But typically, somebody's getting onto a CGM relatively quickly. It does, you know, reapprovals, it does usually require prior authorization. So it takes a little bit of time. But so that's the CGM side. Insulin pumps also vary. There are some insurance companies that won't approve them until somebody's had diabetes for at least 6 months. There are some new studies showing like early initiation of insulin pumps within a month or even sooner of diagnosis, that people have really good outcomes with that. So I think that's something. And you know, the guidelines do recommend, so the American Diabetes Association guidelines do recommend to initiate those as soon as feasible, basically, if that's the patient's desire. So I think there's some systems issues that are still catching up with that. And I think there's this question of, you know, we do have to make sure people know how to use an insulin pen, know how to use, how to do manual finger stick checks, and that kids get comfortable with those as well, particularly for really young kids who struggle a lot with that. You do have to familiarize them with it so it doesn't feel like a punishment every time their, you know, their device fails. Or these devices do have warm-up periods as well, and, you know, when you're not getting data. And so, you know, the basics are still important. So I think we're still, as a field, sort of navigating the best timing for some of that.
As far as at least approval goes when it comes to ages, obviously there's who the child is, what the family is, all that type of stuff. But as far as approvals, are they approved all the way down to as, you know, young as 2 or 3? Or, you know, can you do that? Or is it something where, hey, I wouldn't do it above age 8?
Yeah, no, the systems are, many of these systems are approved down to age 2. I think when we have people who are diagnosed very young, they often do end up getting used off-label in that group. If you have an endocrinologist who's familiar and comfortable with that, you know, the automated delivery systems aren't calibrated for that. So typically in kids younger than 2, they're going into that manual mode, sort of the old school way of doing it. But certainly just like less pokes, easier to manage, gives you a little bit more flexibility.
Are there, I know we talked earlier about how the guidelines say that every child should at least be offered a pump. And you sort of talked about how historically there's been this like idea that some kids aren't fit for a pump, or pump doesn't serve some children. Are there situations in your practice where you will transition back to injections from a pump?
So certainly there are people who don't like it. And I think the biggest issue there is, you know, people who don't like having an extra device on their body, or people who have skin sensitivities. So that's actually a big issue, because all of these, you know, use adhesives to stick to the body. And there are tips and tricks to try to get people through it. But I do have one patient who just can't tolerate it. Her skin just cannot tolerate any of the adhesives that we can find. And so I think, you know, certainly if it's patient preference, or if there are, you know, the compounding factors like that with the skin challenges, that can be one issue. Sometimes insulin needs can change rapidly during illness, or if somebody receives steroids. So those are times sometimes when somebody has to go back into manual mode rather than the automated delivery mode, because it just can't account for that really increased need with some of these systems. In the hospital, if it's a young child and nobody can be at the bedside to operate it, sometimes we will need to transition somebody off of a pump. And then the other time when like we really see that is active suicidality, because obviously insulin is a high-risk medication.
I wouldn't have thought about suicidality. That's helpful. So I know insurance and cost are huge questions when it comes to pumps and CGMs, and it's like constantly the bane of my own personal existence. So I would love to hear you talk about what I should be doing differently so that this goes smoother.
If you could fix it, Hartley, I don't have perfect advice here. So cost and insurance coverage are huge issues with diabetes devices. And I think in general, we can get these devices covered for people with type 1 diabetes. They require prior authorizations. It requires paperwork. The challenge is that the out-of-pocket cost for patients can still be quite high, even with insurance coverage. So the majority of continuous glucose monitors, the most commonly used ones, the Dexcom and the Libre, are now available through pharmacy. So for Dexcom and Libre, you can prescribe those through the pharmacy. So they go through someone's pharmacy benefits. And that is a little bit more straightforward. There are sometimes issues with the local pharmacy actually getting their hands on the devices, particularly in some of the more rural areas where we live. But in general, if the pharmacy knows that the patient, you know, if that's the where they fill all their prescriptions, they can get what they need. So we have so CGMs can go through pharmacy benefits. The copays can still be quite high. You know, the Libre is less expensive. So out of pocket for the Libre, you can usually with like a good RX coupon get a month's supply for less than $200. The Dexcoms are quite a bit more expensive out of pocket. But in general, people's copays end up being the same if they're going through pharmacy, but they can be quite high. If they're going through insurance, but they can be quite high. Insulin pumps are more complicated. So two of the available pumps that we talked about, the Omnipod 5 and the Twist, the one that's just now coming out, are available through the pharmacy. So they go through someone's pharmacy coverage, and they tend to, for most people, the out-of-pocket cost is less expensive. The challenge with the other pump systems, and actually Tandem is starting to have some of their supplies available through the pharmacy, but that's just recently rolled out. The majority, for the other systems, they all go through durable medical equipment benefits or DME benefits. I can't generalize about insurance, but many insurance plans, the coinsurance for durable medical equipment supplies is around 30%, which means that you are paying for 30% of the out-of-pocket cost for the item. So a new insulin pump, like the device itself, for many of these brands is more than $10,000. So for many commercial insurance plans, somebody has to come up with out-of-pocket. First, they have to meet their deductible, which people with diabetes always do by the end of the year for the most part, unfortunately. So if they haven't met their deductible, they'll have to pay their full deductible and then 30% of whatever's left of that $10,000. So it's often upwards of $3,000 that people have to come up with, even with, you know, quote unquote, good commercial insurance plans. So it can be a significant out-of-pocket cost that makes it difficult for some families to reach. And so sometimes that plays a role in the decision. If, you know, the Omnipod 5 is covered through someone's pharmacy benefits and their copay ends up being a lot lower, often that's the direction that they'll go. I think, you know, in general with Medicaid plans, they tend to be covered with very low cost, even the you know, durable medical equipment. But I think for people who are just not qualifying for Medicaid, it can be really challenging.
And just logistically, prescribing the CGM, honestly, we're not going to prescribe the insulin pump as the generalist, but I could easily see myself discharging a patient from the hospital with the insulin recommendation plus the CGM, or, you know, if I'm primary care clinic, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. So the prescription that I'm writing, does it automatically come with the handheld device if I'm writing to a pharmacy, say Libre or Dexcom, or is that a different choice that I'm making, and does that cost extra? So just so I know whether the patient's using the phone or the choices that they can make, and I want to make sure I'm not overcharging them, for example.
Great question. So that is something I always ask people. I say, would you even use a receiver if you had it, or are you planning to use your phone? Because the receiver is a separate device and a separate copay. And in most EMRs, it's like, you know, it'll say Dexcom G7 receiver, Dexcom G7 sensor. So the Libre and the Dexcom, the most recent versions of them, both have an integrated sensor and transmitter. So that's a single prescription. And so a lot of patients were excited about that integrated because it's one less copay. The one step earlier version of the Dexcom, which is called the G6, had a separate sensor and transmitter. And so that was two separate prescriptions. So starting someone on that device often took like three separate prescriptions in order to, and, you know, three separate copays in order to get started.
Going along other types of CGM devices. So I know that we have these over-the-counter CGM devices, which are really meant for type 2 diabetic adults who are not on insulin. But, you know, looking at some of the prices that they have for these over-the-counter versions, they come in pretty a lot cheaper than some of these copays that you're telling about. Like, are these things that can be used like off-label, quote-unquote? I know people can't see my finger quotes.
I mean, that would be an extremely off-label use of those devices. The biggest issue with them is their accuracy is less, particularly at low blood sugars. They do not alarm if a blood sugar is going low, so there's no alert if the blood sugar is going low. And I think for both of the systems out there right now, they don't tell you what the blood sugar is if it's below 70. They just say below 70, which is not... It's tough because your other option is five finger sticks a day, having continuous data in some ways is better. On the other hand, that data is quite a bit less accurate. I don't know the MARDs of those devices off the top of my head, but I know that part of the reason they're cheaper is that they are not as accurate. And so I think it could be challenging to use them in somebody who takes insulin.
So I think we should talk, you know, we're talking a lot about cost, which is kind of an obvious disparity how those things kind of come to play with patients and access to care. But I was hoping you could still dive into it, especially as a researcher in this field, with different types of disparities that you see amongst patients with type 1 diabetes.
So there's a lot of data showing that people in minoritized racial groups are less likely to use pumps. And there are a lot of smart people looking into this, trying to encourage use. I mean, we do know that diabetes is more, type 1 diabetes is more common in people of European descent. And so there may be some, there's a thought that there may be some community barriers, cultural barriers within different groups of people not wanting to use devices, not wanting to be obvious about their diabetes. But there's also a lot of data showing that provider bias plays a big role here as well. And so I think that, you know, attention's being called to this, and there's a lot of work being done in this. You know, the guidelines now say everybody needs to be offered a pump. But I think there's still, this is still a big issue. And I think there's a lot of smart people working on this, but it's still a major issue in the United States.
Yeah. Are there other disparities that you see?
So I do think that health literacy and, you know, executive function can play a role here, that people who have more difficulty just kind of like getting their act together with diabetes tend to be the people who people say, you know, I don't think this person could handle a pump. This is just too complicated for them. And there are ways in which that's fair, because managing all the supplies for a pump, making sure you have everything you need, it's a silly thing, but like the durable medical equipment suppliers don't have an app, or many of them don't have like websites that you can go onto to refill. So you have to call. And it's just these barriers of somebody who, you know, if you are working a certain type of job during business hours where you can't make a call, that's a huge barrier to being able to get your supplies. And then if you're not able to get your supplies, then you're, you know, running out of insulin, going off the pump unexpectedly can be a risk for diabetic ketoacidosis. So I think there are some groups that, you know, historically have not been offered pumps as often. I think that that's changing. And we have some data that we've collected recently showing that some of these groups are starting to be using insulin pumps at similar rates in terms of those with executive function challenges. So more to come on that. I'm like scooping my own eventual manuscript here, but
we appreciate it.
I think we're moving in the right direction.
So let's talk a little bit about us as the generalist, for example. We're not endocrinologists, but we love to try to figure out on the show how we can be kind of first visit endocrinologists. How do you expect us to interact with all these devices? Can we even access this data? How would you recommend us doing anything as the generalist?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the CGM that is used by the most people with type 1 diabetes is the Dexcom brand. And Dexcom does have an option for, without you as the provider having an account with like a clinic account for the Dexcom cloud, the patient can generate a share code that you just plug in on their website and it will show you the data. So without having your own login, without having your own information. And so if you're just like curious about it, you have a patient with diabetes, you want to see what this looks like. If, you know, if they're willing to share, I think it's interesting to see what that looks like. For insulin pumps, it's more limited. I think in reality, as I mentioned, you know, even for us as endocrinologists, it's getting complicated to know what to change on which system. And you know, in general, there should really be only one person managing insulin dosing. But I think an awareness of like how these systems work, of the, you know, the importance of keeping the device on the body, and just understanding the ways in which those automated insulin delivery systems can make life easier. I think there are a lot of teens and young folks who are hesitant about pumps, who feel anxious about it. And I think it's obviously people's own choice whether or not they want to use a device. But I think with the growing data we have, and as these devices get more advanced, of just how much we can improve people's outcomes, and make diabetes management easier, you know, supporting that use. I think I feel like that sounds really minimal, but I think it's actually a huge piece in this, that, you know, just because you're not the one managing the insulin doesn't mean you can't play a supportive role. And I think in general, just, you know, asking people with diabetes, how are things going with your diabetes? Giving them space to talk, and you know, vent about it if needed is another important space.
So continue along the lines of us as a journalist playing a supportive role. You know, sometimes if there are issues with some of these devices, I know they will probably know that they should contact the endocrinologist or the manufacturer, because I know they all probably have support lines and things like that. But what are some common things that we might accidentally stumble upon that, you know, a patient or a family may come to us, say, hey, I'm having an issue here. And what are some ways that you think we as a general pediatrician would be able to help in these cases?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think one of the, you know, as I mentioned earlier, one of the risks with pumps is the cannula kinking, that can lead to higher risks of DKA. So, you know, if somebody's using a pump and is ever contacting you about unexplained high blood sugars, change the infusion site. Give insulin via injection and change the infusion site, because that is the most like, and check ketones. So those are kind of like the three pieces that, you know, sort of are the first steps. And, you know, obviously contacting the endocrinologist as well. But like, you know, you guys all know, if ketones are elevated, go to the hospital. Sometimes if ketones are only modestly elevated, we can help manage things at home if somebody can change an infusion site and get back on track. But for the most part, you know, if somebody has ketones, making sure they're contacting endocrinology. I think another thing for the sensors just to be aware of is they tend to be less accurate on the first day and the last day. And so I think sometimes just if that's something people are complaining about, that's one thing that's one thing just to be aware of. And those can be times when it's important to check a finger stick and confirm those settings, those levels, particularly if they don't make sense.
Weird. So less accurate in the first, is it because like it's calibrating the first day and then it's dying on the last day, or like,
I think of it as like, you know, the entry into the sub-Q tissue is traumatic. And think that like, this is my hand wavy response. You can see my hands waving. That, you know, it takes some time for everything to sort of reorganize and settle. And so that first day, so some people actually do something called pre-soaking the sensors, where they put new sensor on like 12 hours in advance and wait out, you know, while they still have an old sensor going, and then they don't start the new sensor until after some time has passed. So there are like tips and tricks like that can help with some of those inaccuracies.
And just while we're talking about troubleshooting the obvious highs and lows, you kind of talked about highs, you know, hey, this insulin clearly isn't delivering as much as you can. You can always, you know, if it's manual, you tell it to bolus some more insulin, like the usual things that we would do. And then if it's not delivering correctly, you know, give yourself the sub-Q shot and then bring yourself to a different site. What about lows? You know, lows with an insulin pump. So you're no longer on long-acting glucose. You're no longer on long-acting insulin. So you're not on a glargine, for example. You know, how should we be treating lows in association with an insulin pump? How quickly do things go up? Does it start giving insulin? Can you kind of talk us through that just so we can give our patients advice? Like if they call and they say like, okay, drink some juice or don't drink some juice or unplug the thing, you know, like what are we supposed to do here?
So the benefit of these pumps is that typically you're not having as many lows because they're able to withhold some insulin in order to prevent the lows. I think there is sort of a difference that we recommend for treating lows to actually treat lows with less glucose. So the rule of thumb for treating a low blood sugar is 15 grams of sugar, wait 15 minutes and see if it's come up. There's a few caveats to that to people who are using technology. One is that the sensor is going to lag behind real life. So it may, you know, you really, if you're really worried, you're still feeling low after 15 minutes, check a finger stick blood sugar and see where you're at, because that will be more accurate. I think the second piece is that because these devices are withholding insulin, it actually can take less glucose to treat the low. less sugar to treat the low. So we actually sometimes recommend people start with like a half the amount of sugar that they would otherwise take to treat that low blood sugar. Because otherwise, if you end up going high and then it just sort of starts this like roller coaster cycle, that can lead to a really bad day. And so trying to, you know, take just enough sugar, and it's tough because when your blood sugar is low, you feel terrible and want to eat everything a lot of the time. And so it can be really difficult to, in that moment, like restrain yourself to eating 8 grams of carbohydrates, which, you know, is about 5 gummies. So I think that's that can be a challenge, is sort of, because once you get in that cycle of highs and lows, it can sometimes be tough to break.
And does the machine or the app, when you do you type in when you're correcting a low, like you usually type in a meal, for example, do you also type that in, or do you just do it on your own and then it just figures it out?
No, actually, you typically don't type anything in when you're doing that. Good question.
So as we're...
I'm ready.
So as we're wrapping up here, I'd love to just touch on my favorite thing, which is kids being kids. And I'd love if you could talk a little bit about what having a CGM and an insulin pump looks like for kids' daily life. Like, how do you play sports? What happens if someone hits your insulin pump? All sorts of that good stuff.
Yeah. It's so important. And I think there's a lot of these issues that are reasons that a lot of kids and teens love the Omnipod 5 so much, because it is a patch pump that does not have a tube. And it granted, you still can have adhesive issues because it's a big device stuck on your body, but it's there. And so I think with sports, you know, people with diabetes play all the sports, and particularly with contact sports, you really have to make sure that tubing is well tucked, is well put away before somebody is out there, because you don't want that tubing to get yanked, the pump site to get dislodged. It can be a really significant interruption. And so, you know, in troubleshooting that, wearing like a tight compression layer underneath, so some compression shorts with like a tight pocket where you can fit everything in. Like, you know, there are exercise shorts that have like a little waistband pocket that, you know, you're supposed to like tuck your keys into or whatever, but you can fit the pump into there often. So I think that can help for people who are wearing the tubed pumps. But I do think that's a reason a lot of folks do opt for the Omnipod, because it doesn't have that tubing issue. An Omnipod can still get knocked off your body in football practice, so it's not completely fail-proof. But I think, you know, making sure that your sports bag has replacements for everything, has a, you know, a vial of insulin in it, has the things that you need to replace. For swimming like notoriously causes lows. It's just, it does take a lot of muscles. And it's one of those things that kids always go low when they're swimming. And CGMs do not transmit well through water. So, you know, when swimming, particularly with young kids, we'll say every 15 minutes, like get that. I mean, it's not fun. That kind of sucks to have to get out every 15 minutes and like go stand by your receiver until it connects. Or like sometimes mom or dad will like come over by the side of the pool and like hold the thing, and they'll like, you know, put their arm up and try to get it to read, just so you have a sense of where things are at. In terms of the pumps, most of them are not waterproof. So the Omnipod is waterproof, which again, I think it's a, people like it because of that. But the others are detachable. And so they detach at the site. People put a little clip a little plug in, and then they do have to come out and give some insulin every once in a while. You know, you can't swim for 4 hours with no insulin going in, but it's definitely manageable. So I think that, you know, there's lots of different kids with diabetes, as you guys all know, can do all the things that kids without diabetes can do. And there are people doing all the things. So you can find the community out there that can help your person troubleshoot hockey pads or like whatever it is they're trying to do.
And just along the swimming, sorry, can you just talk about showering real fast? It seems like less water, but same concept.
Yeah, same concept. So people will disconnect a shower, and that's when I always tell people to charge their pumps, because then, you know, you're charging it daily, hopefully, at that time when it's already disconnected from your body. The Omnipod is waterproof, so that stays on the body when you go in the shower.
Cool. Do we have any other questions before we just start asking about future tech?
Yeah, I feel like there should be something more about is there something we're not asking about daily life? You know, for someone who's lived with this or someone who's done it, you know, what should people know for the daily life? I feel like those were not enough to talk about.
I think the biggest thing that I hope that providers understand is just like, it's a lot of work. It's type 1 diabetes, I think, is one of the conditions. There are a few others out there, but type 1 diabetes, I think, is one of the conditions that requires the most work of the individual. Like, we're asking people to calculate, to check a lab value and calculate a dose of an extremely high risk medication and give it to themselves multiple times per day. You know, in the hospital, two nurses have to sign off on the insulin dose. Like, you know, I've got 16-year-olds out there just like doing it on their own, which is appropriate. You know, they're learning to self-manage. But I think that it is easy for there to be a lot of blame on people for diabetes management. And, you know, I think if I didn't have diabetes myself and see, it's like I eat the exact same thing for breakfast. And truly, some days I am high and some days I am low, and I can never predict which it's going to be. And so there's just a lot that we don't account for that these algorithms can't account for. That, you know, things are so, you know, I put my first pump on about 20 years ago. So I've maybe more. So I've been doing, you know, using a pump for a long time. And so the amount that things have changed since I was a kid, since I was diagnosed, is shocking. And, you know, I have patients, I'm an adult provider as well. So I have patients who have had diabetes for more than 50 years who, I mean, the change that people have seen in diabetes management is incredible. But there's also some evidence that, like, as people, for example, between like blood sugar, finger sticks, and a CGM, the amount that people worry about their diabetes actually increases because they're confronted with it more. So I think just the mental load, it's still a lot of work. It's a really challenging condition to manage. But I do think we're getting to a point where we are starting to see these devices come out that are actually starting to decrease the mental load of diabetes.
Speaking of which, let's talk about future tech. What are some cool things that you want to share that we can expect to see in the future? Because we were talking offline, it sounds like there are some pretty cool things. So
I think the thing that I'm most excited about is the bi-hormonal pumps that are being evaluated. And so, you know, in type 1 diabetes, there is insulin deficiency, but there's also dysregulation of glucagon because of that insulin deficiency. And so the sort of newest generation of pumps that are being tested right now, and there's one that I believe is now approved in Europe, are these bi-hormonal pumps that have both insulin and glucagon in them. The limiting factor to this for a long time was shelf-stable liquid glucagon. The old-school glucagon kits were like a powder that you had to like reconstitute with a diluent. And it's only relatively recently, within the last 5 years, that shelf-stable liquid glucagon has been available. And so I think that has really opened up the possibility for a pump where if your blood sugar is going low, instead of just withholding insulin, you can just give a little bit of glucagon. So it will allow for algorithms to be more aggressive, to give more insulin up front to prevent a high blood sugar after a meal. And then when the blood sugar starts to drop, give glucagon. That's what a healthy pancreas does on its own. And that's how the system works. So I think this is going to be a real game changer in diabetes management. It's the thing I'm most excited for.
So truly like an artificial pancreas.
Right.
Very cool. Very cool. Anything else we want to talk about? Is there anything else you want to share with us before we hit to our take-home points?
No, I think that's it from my end.
All right. Well, Becca, then how about you give us some take-home points for our listeners?
So I think like the number one thing is like modern insulin pumps are very different from pumps from 5 to 10 years ago. So depending on when you trained, things may be quite different. So I think just being aware of this like automated system that might be working in the background is really important. And I think, you know, the fact that these devices are giving us more in-range blood sugars without significantly increasing someone's mental load of their diabetes, I think it's a big advance in the technology. But As I said before, you know, these systems are not perfect and they still take a lot of work, a lot of input from the individual. You know, you don't just slap on the pump and it manages the diabetes. It still takes a lot of input from the individual. And I think, you know, supporting people, meeting them where they are, you know, helping people do their best and celebrate those incremental wins is the best way to support people with type 1 diabetes.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for spending tonight with us. I know it was sort of a longer talk, but basically, you know, Hartley, Sam, and I, we basically asked all the questions we've really been wanting to ask for all these years, and we're so happy that you were here to answer those questions, and I'm glad that our listeners were able to come along for the ride.
Well, yeah, I'm happy to be here and happy that you guys are answering these questions, because I know that, you know, more and more of these devices are starting to interface with you know, sort of generalist care as well.
Awesome. Before we sign off, do you want anything that you want to plug for our audience? Any websites or organizations you think people should be checking out?
I think, you know, to learn more about some of the different pump systems out there, there is a website called diabeteswise.org. It's actually a patient-facing website that's made by health providers, some of whom have diabetes themselves, to sort of compare the different systems that are available out there and just like some of the nuances of the different things. So I direct a lot of my patients there, and I think for people who want to learn a little bit more, that's a helpful place to start.
Awesome. That sounds like a great website.
Yeah. It's going to be perfect for us.
All right. Well, thank you again for spending time with us tonight. I appreciate the time you spent.
This has been another episode of the Cribsiders.
It's for the kids!
Get show notes and sign up for our bi-weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. Special thanks to our producer for this episode, Dr. Hartley Lidsky, and our wonderful social media team, which is mostly Dr. Denise Cruz on X, Blue Sky, and Instagram. I've been Sam Mazur.
I'm Hartley Lidsky.
And this has been Chris, the G-Man G. Thank you and good night. And of course, those who have accidentally continued to listen towards the end after the outro, you're going to be blessed with another poem written by AI. It's titled Pumped Up Kids. Gone are the days of constant pricks. Technology now does the tricks. CGM, watch the glucose flow while pumps deliver what kids need to know. Sensors placed beneath the skin track the sugar dancing within. No more guessing, no more fear. Real-time data crystal clear. Automated loops take control. Insulin doses towards the goal. Basal's bolus all in sync, giving families time to think. From swimming pools to soccer fields, this tiny tech protection yields. Through alarms may sound at night, freedom's worth the gadget's sight. The future holds such promise bright for kids who fight this daily fight. With pumps and sensors by their side, sweet victories they can't hide. All right, I guess that's it. Bye, guys.